LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Gary Lachman, who joins us to discuss his latest book, The Secret Teachers of the Western World. This epic study unveils the esoteric masters who have covertly impacted the intellectual development of the West. Running alongside the mainstream of Western intellectual history, there is another current which, in a very real sense, should take pride of place, but which for the last few centuries has occupied a shadowy, inferior position somewhere underground. In this clarifying, accessible, and fascinating study, Lachman explores the Western esoteric tradition as a thought movement with ancient roots and modern expressions, which in a broad sense regards the cosmos as a living, spiritual, meaningful being, and humankind as having a unique obligation and responsibility within it. This is in stark contrast to much of modern science, which sees the universe as a meaningless flow of matter and energy, and human beings as pointless accidents. Hello and welcome, Gary, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Oh, it's my pleasure indeed, Greg. Thank you very much.
Gary, today we're going to be talking about your latest book, which is entitled Secret Teachers of the Western World. As per usual, just for people who maybe aren't so familiar with your work, tell listeners a little bit about your background in general.
I write about what we can call the Western esoteric or Western inner or hermetic tradition. And that this is this sort of counter tradition to the, you know, the standard Western intellectual one. And this includes a variety of different, sort of esoteric or inner occult mystical sort of teachings and doctrines from, Hermeticism and Gnosticism and the Kabbalah and Theosophy and a variety of things like that. The latest book traces the history of this from its earliest, roots in the ancient world into contemporary times, but I've also written books about specific figures, mostly from more modern times, people like Madame Blavatsky or Rudolf Steiner, Peter Uspensky and Aleister Crowley. And I've also written about specific historical periods, the 1960s and early 70s, which saw a cult revival, a sudden and very influential mass interest in all things occultly marvelous, as the historian Theodore Roszak called it. Prior to doing this, many years ago, I was a musician. I was one of the founding members of the group Blondie back in the early mid 70s. And yes, I did that for quite some time, and then left that world some years later, and more or less reemerged many years later, writing about these sorts of subjects, which I've been doing for the last 20 years or so.
Now, you mentioned their Western esoteric tradition, which, you know, again, a lot of your writings have been about. For some people, that'll be a little bit, it'll seem a little bit anomalous to them. Western, you know, what the Western societies is all about, you know, rationality and science. It's Eastern mysticism that we hear so much about. And that's what you talked about, the counterculture in the 60s. And that was all that Eastern stuff. So, but I always felt that, my first exposure to some of these ideas, I can remember picking up a copy of a book called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail back in the 80s. And I started then, from that, it led me on to reading like you say, Gnostics came up, and reading about the Templars, about Masonic mysteries, and this name, the Illuminati, came up. And I started to get this feeling, Eastern traditions and mysticism all set to one side, that there was something else here in the Western tradition that was being kept from us. Not implying anything conspiratorial, but there was something that was necessarily had retreated at some point in history and gone underground. And there was something here that really was being completely set aside, and either deliberately by design or by accident, whatever, it was being hidden.
Well, that's pretty much the argument I make in my recent book, The Secret Teachers of the Western World, where esoteric tradition, this other tradition, actually was subject to a kind of character assassination, a smear campaign starting in the early 1600s with the rise of science. So it had hitherto been very prestigious. It's more common knowledge now than it had been, but someone as prestigious as Isaac Newton, you know, who's considered more or less the father of the modern world, father of modern science. He wrote much more about alchemy and sort of biblical exegesis, and sort of wanting to know the secrets of the universe than he did about gravity. So many other equally renowned names from the past, and I talk about quite a few of them in the book, were deeply involved in this, what was called the occult sciences. And the occult really means not seen. Can mean hidden, but it's not necessarily hidden in the sense of something that's, very, very, like, dark secret. It's just that it's not perceived by the senses. It's something that's perceived by the mind or the spirit. Esoteric means inner. Exoteric is the outer surface of things. The esoteric is the sort of inner core of it. And that can mean both the inner core of a religion, or a philosophy, or a kind of teaching. There's an esoteric side to Christianity, esoteric side to Judaism, to Buddhism and Hinduism and so on, but also the inner in human psychology, our own inner world. Esoteric sciences have to do with consciousness, more or less, even though they don't use that word. It's mostly spirit, something along those lines, but in actual sort of practice and the experience of it, the two are pretty much synonymous. And yes, there's been a long tradition of this in the West, going back to the beginnings of what we would call, the Western mind or the Western intellectual tradition. You know, one of the earliest people, Pythagoras, who everyone learns about his theorem in school, I imagine they still teach it these days, and who we also know, was supposed to have discovered the octave, and who believed that number was at the center of everything. He's one of the earliest sort of Greek philosophical, early scientific, minded people to emerge out of the previous kind of mythic world. In the beginning then, the inquiring Western mind was also interested in this sort of inner kind of experience as well. And that runs through Plato and so on and so on. But yes, you're right. Historically, what happened is that the West became associated, certainly by the 1600s, by the 17th century, with this new, logical, scientific, specific, factual, empirical approach to things. And what I say in the book is that it purposefully went out of its way to disparage the other way of knowing that's associated with this esoteric tradition, which is, it's a different kind of, it's a more immediate, more intuitive way of knowing the world, whereas the scientific, rational one, as we know, is rational and logical and scientific and empirical and sequential and dealing with facts and so on and so on. And so what happened in the West is that we couldn't, this became a cult, this became sort of tarred with this brush of, you know, being dark and, you know, satanic and, you know, so on and so on. All the kind of cliche ideas we have about the occult. And in the beginning of the late 18th and certainly getting up going in the late 19th century, there was a Western surge of interest in the East, specifically because it didn't have available its own spiritual tradition to itself, and so it saw this in the East. But no, certainly it's there. And even someone like Madame Blavatsky, who's one of the people responsible for introducing Eastern ideas into the West in a popular way. I mean, she herself, in her first book, Isis Unveiled, is much more about the Western Hermetic tradition. And this is basically what we could call science, but a magical kind of science. And what she wanted to do was to show, you know, the two weren't necessarily opposed. Although she was very much against the rising reductionist materialist science that we associate, you know, with the 19th century and its scientific view. But no, I mean, it's there. That tradition is there. And, again, we can understand and see its influence on what we know as the mainstream Western intellectual, spiritual, cultural tradition, without having to resort to any kind of conspiracy theories. Because it's just there. I mean, these people have just kind of been airbrushed out of the story, through the kind of perceptions about the occult or about mysticism or about the esoteric that under which most of Western history has been written. You know, there's a certain. I mean, the main kind of motor of the book is. Using ideas from another book called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist. And it's a brilliant book. And what it does is it reboots the whole right and left brain sort of dialogue, which, as we know, became very, very popular in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s, and then it sort of dropped out of favor with scientists and so on and so on, and because of its popularity.
Yeah, I'll come along to that in a moment because I want to talk about that at some length because I think it's very, very important. Mm-hmm. Just to rewind very slightly, do you think that the aforementioned suppression of the mythical and mystical in the initial stages, at least, despite, you know, Darwin and Newton and what have you, mm-hmm. having mm-hmm. All these other sorts of areas of interest, do you think in the initial stages the suppression was very practical and kind of pragmatic? In the sense that, oh, we really do need to get this stuff put to one side because we're advancing here at a rate of knots. You know, there's a whole new world emerging to us here, the scientific world. So at some point, it was for the most part just seen in the same way that a lot of religious ideas were getting pushed aside because it was seen as irrational.
Well, I mean, it's precisely what you say. It was practical. It was not seen as practical. And that's what became sort of dominant. Not only in sort of the ideas being applied as practical science in that sense, but just for getting things done. You're precisely right. I mean, I say in the book, in order to understand the laws of planetary motion, we have to sort of forget. Dante says, you know, the love that moves the sun, the moon, and the other stars. I mean, you know, that's how science worked. It sort of had to subtract all those kinds of things. Let's just see what happens. Let's look at it and see what happens. And then, we can account for what happens without having recourse to all of these non-verifiable, mystical, spiritual kinds of things. And we can account for them purely in terms of, you know, physical forces. And yes, you're right. But even that shift, the shift into that being seen as kind of an end in itself that took precedent over other ways of being in the world, other ways of knowing the world. That in itself was a particular kind of shift too. So because the practitioners of, as I said, Newton was. He considered his work in alchemy science just as much as he considered, you know, the work he was doing on laws of planetary motion and physics and gravity and all that. He wanted to know the mind of God just as much as Stephen Hawking does, or whoever is the one doing that these days. So, yes, there was a peculiar kind of shift towards a kind of effectiveness, you know, with knowledge, a kind of knowledge that led to results, that led to predictable results, you know, and that could be quantified, measured. The sorts of things that the Hermetic philosophies, ways of knowing deal with, are they're not quantifiable.
It's interesting, you know, considering the what you're talking about, this timeline of a scientific revolution, and despite some of these pioneering scientists, you know, as you say, having a foot in different worlds, that this gradually begins to change and the emphasis shifts. And to a lot of casual observers, particularly students of science, the idea that any of these Western or Eastern, for that matter, esoteric traditions would be surviving and kind of struggling to still survive underground or bubble to the surface here and there, that would be kind of news. They might think of, for example, that the most significant bubbling up of a different kind of consciousness might have been, you know, in the 60s counterculture the Age of Aquarius and all what happened there. But really, it's been an ongoing thing. With obviously limited success, but this is it's almost like an eternal struggle.
I one of the things I say is this, you know, I've certainly heard, over the 40 years I've been interested in this kind of thing and, you know, reading about it and so on, I've certainly heard more than one scientist say that it's all debunked. You know, we figured out, you know.
Yes.
We've explained it all away already, and I mean, we can put this to bed, but they keep doing it. You know, they keep dragging out this dead horse and beating it. And, you know, that just says to me, like, well, actually, you know, it isn't debunked. It's something that's there all the time. It's infuriatingly, elusive and difficult to pin down in some way. I totally agree with that. It's something that doesn't really want to abide by, you know, the rules that work for, you know, science, as the way it works best. And this is why scientists who look at this kind of stuff, they dismiss it because, oh, well, you know, it just doesn't fit the kind of things that we, you know, we're good at figuring out. I totally agree with that. I mean, I can't say that I have a particular theory that accounts for these sorts of things. And there's a variety of different things ranging from, say, paranormal experiences to mystical experiences and Gnostic sort of, other, as I said, sort of ways of knowing, you know, different ways of knowing the world. But I certainly know, as much as I know things that I can verify, that these things do happen, and, you know, they're real and they're part of our experience. And, but they, you know, they're not amenable to the kind of repeatability and kind of, what do you want to say? You know, they're not on tap in the same way that other kinds of phenomena that science covers are. You know, the laws of gravity are always there all the time, and they'll work all the time. So you don't have to have specific kind of circumstances involved in order for them to work. They just work all the time. Whereas these other things aren't like that. They're not print on demand.
Well,
they're not sort of pay-per-view. You know,
well, exactly, and if they are, it's a different movie each time, you know. So at this point, a question might well be a reasonable question. Well, what happened if there was this acceptance of randomness and chaos and risk at one point in the human experience, but there were other things that were safe and predictable, and that's fine, and there was this balance between the two we accepted? At what point did this psychotic craving, because that's what it is, psychotic craving for safety and predictability and measurability just come to dominate? And why would that be? And this brings us on to what you were mentioning earlier, the left-right brain thing. So just for people who don't understand that just give us an overview of that whole the principle.
Right, okay. Well, I was saying earlier, in the beginning of my book, I talk about reading a book called The Master and His Emissary. And it's by E. McGilchrist, who's a psychologist and studies the brain, but he's also an English scholar and studies literature. So in a way, he has sort of, you know, one foot in each side, as it were. And saying, we all know sort of the cliches about the left and right brain, about the left brain being a scientist and the right brain being an artist and the left brain being interested in logic and the right brain being interested in intuition and all that. And that was all very popular, you know, for a while. And then it fell out of favor with sort of serious, in quotation marks, neuroscientists, because the kind of neat separation of function that seemed to be happening with the two different hemispheres. You know, our brain is, you know, the top of the human brain, the cerebral cortex, is this kind of like cap. It's over the lower parts of the brain, and it's separated into two hemispheres. And nobody really knows why we have two different brains, but we do. And it seemed to be that they performed different sorts of functions, but then after a while it turned out that actually they more or less do the same thing. I mean, I'm talking in shorthand here, but I'm just trying to explain why it no longer seemed an interesting question, why we had two brains. And then, but what McGilchrist has done is he's rebooted this and saying, yes, it may be the case that, you know, both sides of the brain participate in many, or if not all, of the different functions, but how they do, it's not what they do, it's how they do it. They do things very differently. And to make a long story short, the left brain, its emphasis is analysis, and it has a very practical attitude towards the world, and it's our way of dealing with the world. And the way it does this is that it basically breaks the world up into these independent kind of discrete things that it can understand in terms of cause and effect and other more or less mechanical ways of understanding the world. And it's absolutely necessary, but it's interested in sort of facts and in parts. It's interested in sort of the bits and pieces that make up the world, because by seeing the world in that way, it can sort of mold it. It can kind of shape the world around it. It's the way we maneuver through the world. Whereas the right brain has a more holistic, immediate simultaneous kind of perception of what is. And it's a broader, not as tightly focused as the left brain. Left brain's very good at focusing on particular objectives, particular things, where the right brain is more wide open to a broader kind of, a deeper, richer kind of immediacy of feeling and meaning and so on. And what McGilchrist says is that what happens is that how they work between each other, there's a kind of rivalry going on between them. And they sort of inhibit each other's excesses. And it's through this kind of inhibitory relationship they have that, you know, we get on and human history has gone on. But he says at different times, the left brain seems to gain a certain dominance over the right. And he's pointed out different times in history when that's happened. And he said most recently it started up the time of, you know, I was talking about the sort of 1600s, early 17th century, sort of the rise of science. And then it got a really, you know, good boost in the Industrial Revolution. Because what the left brain likes to deal with the most is a machine, something made of bits and parts that work together. And that it can sort of understand things and make things like that. It can control the world in that way. And Gilchrist is saying that what it's been doing for the last, you know, couple centuries is making a world much more like itself. The whole world outside is sort of being made into a world like the left brain. And there's less and less of a kind of untouched, you know, non-human world for the right brain just to sort of present, you know, just to be with. You know, there's less and less of it. There's less, in a way you can say it's less and less nature. You know, put it very simple, though McGilchrist doesn't say it in quite that simple way. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying in the book is that if there is this rivalry going on, and I look at some other people who have said similar sorts of things, it strikes me that one of the victims, let's say, of the coup d'etat that the left brain has enacted against the right would be the esoteric tradition, because the kind of knowledge, sorts of things, and the ways of knowing that it's involved with are very much along the lines of the way the right brain knows the world, the right brain interacts with the world. It's much more part of that than the left brain, which is, as you said earlier, much, you know, much more mainstream Western intellectual scientific, rational, logical tradition, and rightly so. I mean, the idea isn't good right brain, bad left brain. The idea isn't to get rid of the left brain and back to the right. You know, both are necessary, both a part of our evolution, and it's through the relationship between the two that we evolve. But as Gilchrist says, there's times when, because the left is very forward going, it's kind of very gung ho. You know, it's very aggressive. The right is much more just sort of in it and immediate and open and vulnerable. It doesn't have the aggressiveness of the left brain. The left brain attacks reality.
When I first read about the left-right brain split, or, you know, if not doing different things, then certainly doing things differently, the first thing I was actually reminded of was the TV sitcom The Odd Couple. but then I tried to think of a more serious analogy.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
But I was immediately reminded of the male-female duality, and how for a long time, particularly, you know, in the modern era, there's been this increasing tendency to stress that there is no difference between male and female, particularly men and women, you know, human males and females. Yeah. And and of course, there are differences, but for me, it was very much about positive differences in terms of complementary differences. And even the word difference is kind of wrong. It's more like, yeah, complementary is the word. It's the yin and yang. It's, you know, black and white, up and down, and what have you. And to try and iron out certain tendencies, we see what happens if men and women. If there's a social situation where you try and aim for this sort of Borg type mentality and approach, the end result tends to be less good. Whereas, and this is what's the thing with the left and right brain is that it's like the right brain can accept the left, if we can imagine these as two little characters, but almost not vice versa, not the way things have been going, as you say, for quite a long time now.
Well, I mean, but I'm not, but yeah, well, but at the same time, They do work together. I mean, McGilchrist is talking about, he's talking about big, broad historical periods. And individuals, you know, I mean, I think, you know, this is the thing. You could have very extreme, I mean, and it's easy to start to kind of, you know, overgeneralize in these ways. And I, just quickly talking about the male, female, or men, woman, you know, sort of differences. Obviously, you know, in one broad sense, you might say men are more left and women are right, but then at the same time, the left-right divide is happening in both sexes as well. So it's not as simple as, you know, one side's one brain and one side's the other. And, you know, like in my own experience, the optimum times, and they do happen, is when they work together, you know.
Well, I was thinking of...
So, I mean, so they do work. I mean, like if you do creative work, let's say, it's a, whatever it is, you know, I think what I'm doing is halfway creative. So, you need a certain you need one side to provide, say, the inspiration, the kind of hunches and intuitions, the bigger kind of vaguer kind of meanings that have a lot of emotional charge to them. You know, the ooh, you know that's exciting. Oh yeah, that's significant. And then the other side has to say, okay, how do we best express that? And so you sort of take that larger but more diffuse kind of sense of immediate kind of meaning, and then you have to articulate it in a clear way. So the left brain, you know, the more critical one, is the one who's, you know, has to choose the right words and so on and so on. So the two do work together. It's not as if we're all completely, overrun by the left and there's no right, but McGilchrist is saying in a broad kind of general cultural sense, it seems to be.
Oh yeah, that's really just what I was getting at. Was sort of the meta trends and where we find ourselves now, and the opportunities versus the threats as we go forward. In terms of, I mean, you're talking about left and right brain working together. You highlight how there seemed to be an integration that took place during the Renaissance, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's other times. I mean, too, you know, and that possibility is always there. I mean, the Renaissance is one of the times when, again, like in our own time, there was a revival of interest in the occult and hermetic sciences. We mostly think of the Renaissance as a time when the ancient Greek writers were rediscovered, mostly, you know, Plato, and that's true. But it was also a time when a collection of writings called the Corpus Hermeticum, were also rediscovered after being lost for a millennium. And these were considered even more important than Plato. Masilio Ficino, who's a great Renaissance Platonist, had been basically hired by Cosimo de' Medici to translate these Platonic texts that had just only recently been discovered. But as soon as Cosimo heard about the Corpus Hermeticum, he told Ficino to, you know, put Plato on the back burner and get to work on these first. So these were considered even more important. And again, this was a time when there wasn't really the kind of split between science and what we now would call the occult or mysticism, as we see it today. They were sort of both considered, you know, just parts of the pursuit of knowledge, although, you know, they didn't have science in the same way we have it. You know, obviously, this is a couple centuries before the rise of you know, what we call science, you know, proper. But still, there was this sort of rational inquiry, you know, but it was also informed by mostly what we consider a Platonic kind of science, a Platonic view of the world, you know, which sees the world as the material world basically as a kind of shadow or reflection of a higher spiritual, intellectual, you know, ideal world, much like many of the Hermetic or esoteric or magical traditions of the West. I mean, Plato, again, Plato is considered one of the, you know, the central minds of Western thought, Western philosophy, but he's also some of his ideas run, you know, throughout the whole current of Western esotericism.
Thinking about the long sweep back into the dark past of human development, you know, which begins, we know, really know not where, I wonder, is this long left-right brain tussle, you know, these periods of integration and disintegration and this, you know, this back and forth that's seen all sorts of different trends and tendencies take place, has this been just part of our development and evolution, or did something go wrong? You know, because a lot of people have written about all sorts of antediluvian disasters and collective trauma, the fall, descent, you know, out of Eden and all the rest of it. Some people say agriculture was a negative development. So I've often wondered if what we've experienced is just, this is the development, this is the development of the brain over millions of years, or whether we did kind of take a wrong turn at some point and we're maybe spent a long time trying to recover from that.
Well, I mean, I know what you mean. I mean, I actually did a book, an earlier book called Caretakers of the Cosmos, where I sort of take argument with this general idea now that somehow human race is a big mistake and, you know, we're a kind of cancer on the planet and all that sort of thing. And that's the complete opposite of the esoteric view, the Hermetic view. I mean, we're actually here. We have a great responsibility here. It's to take care of the cosmos, both in the physical world, but also in our mental, spiritual ones as well. No, I mean, yes, there's all those stories of the fall and some cosmic catastrophe. I mean, these are all, as far as the way I see them, they're all different ways to account for we find ourselves here. You know, we're here, we don't have a rough guide. No one's given us any kind of, you know, instruction what we're supposed to do here. I mean, in a very basic sense, I would consider myself an existentialist because it's from that beginning. You know, that fundamental question of, you know, why, you know, why do I exist? That my own kind of inquiry, you know, begins. And, and we do have a sense that, you know, the thing with our consciousness, we today, our consciousness, we have a much more left brain, we have a greater ability to stand back from the world, from the immediacy of the world. I mean, this is what the left brain can do. It's a way to separate, you know, and the left brain is also associated with our own I, or our ego, you know, the sense of me being a, you know, specific individual, you know, unique identity, you know, that's different from the world around me and the people around me. I mean, that's something that's associated with our left brain. At an earlier time, I think there's good reason to believe that we had a consciousness that was less like that. It was much more what I call participatory. I talk about this in an earlier book called The Secret History of Consciousness, where at an earlier time, probably the last sort of vestiges of it were in the sort of the Bronze Age. There was a kind of a much more, as you say, open relationship between the outer and the inner world. It wasn't quite as definite. The barriers between the two weren't as firm. They were more permeable. And that would also mean less strong a sense of a unique individual I. That's separate from the rest of the world around us. And to be thrown out of this more participatory, richer, warmer, at one kind of unitive consciousness, which I think is the sort of thing we try to get back to through a variety of means, alcohol, drugs, and other sorts of things. Because it left brain consciousness is a burden. You feel the separateness. This is why you have existentialism. This is why you have these kind of crises of identity and meaning. Because you don't feel supported by anything other than your own self, your own ego, and you look around you and you see this world that's, utterly strange and oblivious to you and all that. What is this about? And why do I exist? And all that. And that other richer participatory consciousness, those sorts of questions don't arise. You feel this connected to things around you. And so that kind of alienated self-inquiry doesn't even begin. The separateness that prompts it, you don't experience that. And so we try to regain that. And so, yes, and so in some sense, there's a sense that we left this heavenly, paradise of kind of bliss. But in terms of revolution, we had to leave, just like, the birds have to get kicked out of the nest. I mean, my own feeling is that we didn't fall, we kind of jumped, we parachuted, from that kind of cozier, warmer, unitive consciousness into this, much more difficult, unsatisfactory one. And, I mean, there's different accounts of how that happened. The classic book, Julian James's book, Orange Consciousness and the Breakdown of Bicameral Mind. I mean, he posits that sometime, again, in sort of in the late Bronze Age, probably around 1300 BC, there was a series of catastrophes around the Mediterranean, natural catastrophes and volcanoes and earthquakes and tsunamis, but also pirates and these people called the Sea People, who ravaged the coastal areas, and combination of all these things somehow forced this earlier kind of unitive, more intuitive kind of consciousness to break down. It's so the breakdown bicameral means two-chambered. Basically, he's talking about the two hemispheres of the brain. And I think he's got it turned around. I mean, the way he has it, we have the two sides of the brain. They were kind of working together, and then it. They weren't. They were separated, and then that broke down, and then turned into this kind of, kind of consciousness we have. But I think the kind of consciousness we have is much more associated and lodged in the left brain, and we've more lost touch with the right brain than kind of he has it the other way around. But in any case, the upshot is that there was an earlier time, and other people, other people talk about something very similar. Another person whose ideas I write about quite a bit in the book is the Swiss-German philosopher Jean Gebser, who has a whole huge philosophy about what he calls different structures of consciousness that emerge at different times in history. And some of what he says parallels a great deal of what McGilchrist says. And I draw on both of them to show I was saying earlier how this Western esoteric tradition has fallen victim to this kind of overemphasis on the left brain, practical, effective, dealing with kind of mode of consciousness. and how it's been shunted aside and turned into this kind of, you know, as you were saying earlier, this kind of sort of dark thing. It's either a joke or it's kind of evil or satanic in some way. But actually, it isn't. Either way, I mean, it really is. It's a true tradition of knowledge. It's a true kind of philosophical tradition. There's an inner unity to it. It's talking about the same thing in different ways over time. So it's precisely something. And all you have to do is do a little homework, and you see that throughout the whole history of the West, some of the most important people that we think of were people that involved in it. I said, Newton, there's Goethe, Mozart, Plato, many others, Nobel Prize winners, and so on. So it isn't something that's just like the X-Files or something that's just at Halloween or in some goth rock band. It's actually something that's part of a whole kind of intellectual and spiritual tradition, which we ignore at our peril, because it's rooted in, as you were saying earlier, it's rooted in this whole other mode of consciousness that's associated with our other brain or other way of being in the world. So we're never going to get rid of it. I mean, but the thing is, what we don't want is a bland kind of, you know, blend of the two. There's a creative tension between the two of them that gives birth to this third thing that's greater than both of them. And I use this idea of Jung's, what he calls the transcendent function. It's when you have these two sort of opposed energies or forces in polarity, the tension between them, you know, creates something that transcends them, that sort of goes beyond them. And that's something that, in different ways, that the Western esoteric tradition is also.
We don't want a brave new world of the brain, where everything's kind of ironed out, all the differences are ironed out, and the children of the brain are kind of born somewhere else on a farm.
Yeah. No, I mean, you were saying before this kind of cyborg thing, or this kind of, I mean, I definitely, I think we do. See, it's interesting to me because Gebser said, I said he talks about these different structures of consciousness, but he says he died in 73, but and he wrote his most important book in the 40s, and then did a book called Ever-Present Origin, but kept updating it as it goes along. But he said that what was happening is we were living through what he called the breakdown of the mental rational structure of consciousness. And the mental rational is basically the scientific, logical, sequential view of the world, very much along the lines of what we were saying, the left brain. It's associated with, but he's saying we were seeing that it was breaking down. His structures of consciousness, they exist, you know, for long periods of time, but they go through a kind of, you know, maturity process, and then after they pass their peak, they begin to kind of become overripe and start taking themselves apart, basically. And I think there's lots of evidence for that. You know, I think, you know, Gebser was certainly onto something. And he's not the only person talking about this, but he talked about it in a very specific way, and he came up with an enormous amount of evidence for it. But I do see this kind of, we live in a time when all the barriers are, you know, becoming permeable, and everything that was discrete and unique and separate, this whole, you know, was in a way we're supposed to smash that up together now in some way.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about alcohol and drugs and the kind of altered states that people seem to crave, and this, of course, can lead to dangerous self-destructive behavior and addiction. But at its root, there's something there that's trying to come through. And of course, you don't need, you know, drugs, alcohol, it's all fine. People should do what they want. But the destructive and dangerous side of that, you don't need to go there for that. But it showed people are not quite sure where to look or what to do. There's just something within them that is searching for something.
Well, people have always been interested in in some way, escaping the burden of left brain consciousness, because it is a pain. It's a pain, because I'm saying it, the essence of it is this kind of separateness. And so in different ways, we long for that kind of unitive. And you can get it going to a football game, right? You can get it going to a rock concert. You know, you don't have to take, you know, drugs or alcohol, but we certainly, the reasons why they've always been part of human experience is precisely because of that, because they can do that. And so, I mean, the thing is, for someone like Gebser, he'd be saying, well, what happens when the reason we enjoy them is because they take us, they relieve us of the burdens of the mental rational structure and briefly put us back into an earlier period that he called the mythic sort of structure of consciousness, which is, you know, much like the sorts of consciousness we associate with, you know, altered states, or even just mildly, you know, this, things have a soft edge, you know, we feel a certain all is good kind of feeling, you know, things are less hard, they're less hard-edged, they're less stressful, they're less oppressive than, you know, when our strict left brain kind of thing. But he would say the actual movement of our evolution is not back into that earlier mode, but forward into this other thing he called the integral. Now, you know, again, we could have a whole conversation just about that, of what exactly that means. There's some, you know, I have some discussion of it in the book and all that. And, but it's difficult to talk about this other kind of forward consciousness, let's say, that he foresaw. Rather than stepping back into an earlier one. This is like, I think, what's his name? Ken Wilber got a lot of mileage out of this, the sort of the pre-trans fallacy, where, you know, some people mistake going to a previous mode of consciousness as a transcendental experience, you know, meaning that you're going forward into a higher one. You're actually, you know, slipping back into a more primitive one. The kind of Dionysian unitive consciousness, let's say at a rave or, you know, a festival or something like that. And, I mean, its virtue is that it relieves us of the burden of our own, you know, individual selves, you know.
Well, I think this has relevance to what you were talking about earlier with the book you mentioned, your book, Caretakers of the Cosmos, and we did an interview around that, which people can...
Yes, that's right.
They'll find a link to on this interview page. But one thing, I agree with you in the thrust of that book in terms of our direction of travel and not getting this, you know, pre-trans thing confused. And mm-hmm. one book that came up in your writing that I'm actually in the middle of reading was Owen Barfield's Saving...
Oh, right.
The appearances and this idea of participation in various stages of it.
Oh, it's a brilliant book.
And it is. I mean, the writing's a little bit old-fashioned, so, you know, younger people, it might take a bit of getting used to. But I'm absolutely loving the thrust of his ideas. I think when it was published, it must have been quite mind-blowing. I don't know how many people it actually reached, but that's very
interesting. Well, that book actually gave him a second career, because he had, just briefly, he started out, he was... writer in the 20s, and he was a close friend of C.S. Lewis, and he knew Tolkien, and he was part of that Inkling, you know, group. But he had a few books come out in the 20s, but then he wasn't he got good critical, you know, notes and all that, but he wasn't commercially successful. So he decided he couldn't, you know, pursue it as a living, and he went into the family legal, you know, firm. But then later on, he continued to write off and on. But then many years later, he wrote that book, and that gave him a second career. And suddenly, he was in the early 60s. He was very, very popular on, especially on American campuses in their sort of religious studies departments. That book was something that a lot of people were talking about at the time. So, yeah. I mean, you know, he's brilliant. And interesting enough, he lived to be 99.
You got to interview him, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, a couple of years just before he died. I think I'm pretty sure I did the last interview with him. So it would have been 1996.
One thing I was reflecting on the other day, again, actually while reading Owen's book, was a habit that I've noticed in myself, and I'm sure I've done this all my life, and I'm sure I'm not the only person to do this, but when I talk to myself, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, about an opportunity, a problem, whatever, and I have that inner dialogue, I say we. I say, Greg, we have a problem, or Greg, this is brilliant, we should do this. And I talk to myself like it's two people. I do.
Well, you know, he wrote that, what is it, This Ever Diverse Pair, this very short novel. I mean, it's more like a fable, but he has these two characters. There's Burden and Virgin. And one is this, you know, sort of downtrodden legal, you know, clerk, whatever he was where he worked, a barrister, you know, something out of
Dickens or something.
Yeah, or who's the guy? Rumpole the Bailey,
oh,
or
yeah,
something like that. And then Virgin is this more poetic, you know, vital, you know, spiritual kind of character. And it is precisely as you say, it's a, you know, they have a dialogue. And that's it. And that's, you know, different traditions, you know, have something like that too. You know, this also comes out in the split brain, studies where, you know, we really do have two selves. You know, I said earlier that, you know, my sense of me, comes out of the left brain because it's verbal. The left brain uses words. It speaks. It says I. But I have this other me, this other side that, communicates differently. It communicates in symbols and in imagery and sensations and in moods and hunches and things like that. And, the two of us, you know, have to learn how to get along. This is, you know, that's one of the themes of the book and how so many philosophies express this. I mean, that they may not say specifically, they're not talking about the brains because that, you know, had to wait until, you know, modern, you know, neuroscience and all that, but they're talking about these two kind of, these polarities, you know, these oppositions, you know, the kind of intuitive self and the critical ego. One, you know, that kind of has. I mean, you said earlier the Odd Couple. I mean, Colin Wilson, who I'm working on a book about now. He came up with this way of thinking about the two brains. He called it the Laurel and Hardy theory of consciousness. So he associated the right brain with Stan Laurel, and the left brain with Oliver Hardy. And the way he developed it, he said, if you see in the films where Stan always kind of overreacts, he looks to Oliver, to Ollie, to you know the proper way to be, like what should I do now? And so Wilson said, actually, you know, the right brain sort of looks to the left to give it clues as to how it should, you know, respond to things, and so in a way, you know, it's up to us to sort of give it, you know, the right messages, the positive messages, and so on and all that. So. But yeah, I mean, there is this kind of, you know, sense of a dialogue. And it, in one sense, I ask, is this something that's utterly banal? Because, you know, as you said before, there's the Tao and the yin-yang and the I Ching and, you know, so many other things like that. And the sun and the moon, male and female. And obviously alchemy is completely rife with all these oppositions and polarities. And so is this something that is just so glaringly obvious? Or is it, or because it is something that's so there, we might not, you know, really grasp the real root of the significance. And so,
I don't want to overemphasize this talk of left brain dominance, but this is where, you know, I think I perhaps have been pressing you a little bit on that, or you know, perhaps I have a tendency to overemphasize it. But I'm just thinking about again where we are now in our development as far, and we can't speak about as. As you say, we're individuals, but I'm just thinking species-wide. Mm. I mean, we do have manifestations of some problems along these lines now. And it's been going on. We do have a need to rebalance, which is, it is gathering in urgency, I feel.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was simply going to say that a couple of manifestations, whether it's a sort of a disdain for feminine or a sort of like a dismissing of the of culture and art societally important. We see that now with the, you close the museums, close the art galleries, but keep building the war machines and the rest of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I even see architecture, which is a pet subject of mine, which I always try and shoehorn into a conversation if I can possibly manage it. And I was looking at some of Rudolf Steiner's designs for buildings. And not just he, but others. And for me, our built environment is very much a reflection of the left brain as well. For the most part,
precisely what McGilchrist is saying. You know, mm-hmm. it's intent on recreating the world in its own image, and making things like itself, and in the sense of things that are, you know, machine-like, quantifiable. You know, the kind of I think you're absolutely right, but I mean. So many things that have an anonymous kind of ambiguous character to them. They could be anything. You know, these buildings that, you know, they don't seem to be any particular thing. They could be a shopping center, or there could be a police headquarters or something. They have the same kind of uniform sort of values in their construction. And absolutely. I mean, we're very sensitive to the environment around us. I think you're absolutely right about that. And yeah, I mean, why do we want to get out to nature, or to the wide open spaces, somehow to get towards some non-human world? And again, I'm not down. I wrote a whole book about not being down on humans. So, but I just mean the sense that it's a world that we've had our hand in making around us. And oh yeah, I mean, all you got to do is like walk around London and you just see it constantly. I think you're absolutely right. I mean,
when you see a building like the Shard or the Gherkin, just to use a couple of London examples, you don't have to like these buildings, but people remark on them because they have been designed, and I use design with a capital D, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And design these days, it's kind of, well, people often say, when you look at the latest design of car, for example, and for the most part, they're pretty bland and very much of a muchness. And then you look perhaps at the design of a supercar, and you go, wow, now that looks like something. People say, well, design costs money, But when I see new build houses going up and they're just shoeboxes with square windows and small square windows at that, I say, well, you could put a round window in that bathroom. That wouldn't really cost any more, design costs money. It's the idea that anything edifying is,
We're creating, this is the horror story, is we're creating, We're inmate and guard at the same time, right? We're creating our own prison, and somehow we're living in the prison. I think you're absolutely right. This is the scary side of it. One hopes, perhaps it might not turn so horrible in the end. But I think you're absolutely right. McGilchrist himself. I've corresponded with him, and we've met a couple of times. I mean, he lives up in Skye. So, he's out in the open spaces. And he says as much that's needed these days, very much so. So, I think many of these people, you mentioned Steiner with his architecture, and, he tried to develop ways to incorporate elements of the new modern world. He was one of the early ones to work with, concrete, the second Goethe Annum that went up in the early 20s, after the first beautiful one, which was made of wood. From everything we've seen about it, absolutely remarkable building, that went up in flames. But, he was very aware of how the interior spaces, affect us and how they can draw on the cosmic forces. And that's a very hermetic idea, in different ways. People like Ficino, his ideas influenced architects and artists, Michelangelo, people came after him, but he reopened the Platonic Academy, or started a new one there. Cosimo started it, but made him the head of it. And then those ideas informed, a great deal of the art of that time. So, I mean, this is, we have the ability to do it. But as you say, the powers that be, it's the bottom line, it's the money. This is the practical, functional, dealing with mode of consciousness that predominates now. We art and stuff like that. It gets lip service. It gets some money and all that, but it's just kind of icing, on the cake and all that. But I think, one has to, at least I try to do it. And this book is a history, I try to have a little bit of a meta stance to these kinds of things so that you can see them in a broader picture. So the potential for a kind of creative collaboration between the rival modes of consciousness and the modes of, the one thing I wanted to say is, even if all the stuff about the brains themselves turns out to be not quite as we think, these two modes of consciousness are certainly there, wherever they're anchored, wherever they're located or something. I certainly do think they are associated with the two different sides of the brain, but they're there whether that's the case or not. And we do need the other side. I mean, this is why, we have some of the most influential minds of the time, people investigating you know, the secrets of the universe and the beginning of time and all that. And, you know, they basically fundamentally are saying, well, there's no point to any of this. You know, you know, yes, the universe exists, but it doesn't exist for any particular reason. There's no reason why we exist. We're all sort of chance products of a mindless, you know, kind of oblivious process. And
well, all of this reminds me on how the public react to science as well. And it ties in exactly with what we talked about earlier about looking for that right brain state of consciousness and about wanting whatever you want to call it, art and culture, and this, you know, something other than 9 to 5 and investment banks and war and all the rest of these, wanting something else other than that in your life. And what people are looking for is meaning. And in terms of science, they want to know why, not how, but they're not being told why, because we don't know why.
Well, science can't answer that question. Mm. It doesn't have the means of answering that question, and that's fine. And it should just say, well, we can't answer. We don't ask that question. And many scientists do, but there's also some kind of say like, and well, there's no point asking it because, you know, precisely because we can't answer it. And just to say about art too, I mean, there's a great deal of art that's just as negative as the kind of, you know, it reaches just as negative conclusions as this kind of science I was talking about does too. There's a great deal of real negative, pessimistic art and culture out there as well. So it's not as I'm not saying you're suggesting it, but it's not as simple, you know, breakdown as art versus science or something like that. It's there's a whole kind of set of assumptions that we've lived under, I think, for many, many years, well, centuries now, that say were necessary at the time. They enabled science to develop and create the world that we live in now, which is an incredible world. I mean, you and I just now, we live better than kings did, you know, a long time ago. So, I think we have to give credit where it's due. But the thing is, it in order to be so successful, it had to ignore this whole other side of things. And that wouldn't be so bad if that whole other side of things could develop as well without having to fight, you know, against a whole mindset that basically is saying, not only do we have to ignore you, but we ignored you for good reason because, you know, you're just basically, you know, nonsense. I mean, that's the whole thing, you know.
But
precisely because this right brain, mystical, esoteric mode, poetic mode, whatever you want to call it, it can't produce results in the same way. So it can never prove itself, you know, in the same way that, you know, science can put a man on the moon or, you know, the Voyager out beyond, you know, the solar system. But poetry doesn't do anything. It can't. Unless it moves you. So you have to be open to that in the first place. You have to be open to being able to be moved. And the whole idea that there are meanings and values that have got nothing to do with the bottom line, nothing to do with any of that, that's something I think we are, like, you know, losing more and more touch with.
Yeah, I mean, the divisions that I was talking about, the categories, the names, that they are just that, you know, they're names and they're arbitrary up to a point. It's about ways of thinking, of course, is what we're talking about really here. And it's not about one or the other. That's the whole thrust of this, I think. It's about balance and about, you know, each to its own and, you know, each case on its merits and what have you. It's about a holistic system.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Not a conclusion, but where I come to at the end of the book, as I say, it comes up to contemporary times, is the possibility that, you know, we, with the resurgence of a mass interest in this occult, hermetic, esoteric world, which includes, you know, the Eastern spirituality as well. This is something we've been seeing. You know, it depends how far back you want to go. It certainly is rooted in late 19th century with Madame Blavatsky and the rise of Theosophy. But in more contemporary times, it's something that got going in the early 1960s and has continued as, you know, we call it the New Age or whatever, the alternative, or the search for the new paradigm or whatever. It's had different kinds of names, but it's something that stayed around. And I would say it stayed around because it's a felt, It somehow, in some way, satisfies a felt need for a recognition of this other mode, you know, this other way, whatever you want to call it, you know, this hermetic way, this esoteric, this inner way, that's less to do with dealing and controlling the world than with, you know, grasping meaning. You know, as I said, one mode of consciousness is for dealing with the world, and the other mode is for appreciating the world. You know, the other mode, you know, one wants to get the tree down out of the field because you have to plow it, and the other wants to just gaze at the tree and appreciate its beauty. We sort of give lip service to this, to that one, but, and, you know, and there's reasons for it. You know, life is difficult, so, and we're still an evolving species, and, you know, we had to hack our way through, up the evolutionary ladder, you know, for thousands and thousands of years or whatever. So we're still, I think the problem is that, you know, the virtues of the left brain, let's say, and they're very good virtues and the ones we need, and it's absolutely indispensable. And again, I have to reiterate that it's not a villain, but they work too well. You know, they've overzealous, let's say, and by doing that, they've made it difficult for the virtues of the other side to be appreciated. And you need somehow, yes, I mean, there's all different manifestations of that, you know, I would say. But fundamentally, I would think that that's the sort of gist of it, you know. So there's all different ways of doing that. But I'm saying we kind of have intuitive ways to do it already. We develop rape, you know, we develop art, we develop different ways of kind of getting out of that, you know, relentless kind of practical mode. But I think what we need to do is use that mode itself to become conscious of itself, to understand, you know, what the problem is.
Well, Gary, I mean, you've been writing a lot about some of these historical figures that we've been talking about, you know, some of their work being sidelined and suppressed, and even some of them who are known names, certain aspects of their work being sort of, how shall we say, kindly de-emphasized. Mm. I think, having read quite a lot of your work now, that people looking for, you know, a different way, looking for inspiration and ideas and thoughts about, you know, rebalancing our consciousness and our ways of doing things would find a lot of inspiration here, particularly in the idea that, as I mentioned towards the top of the hour, that this is something that has been ongoing. Mm. You know, there has not been some final triumph of cold, hard, mechanistic science to the exclusion of everything else. All of that stuff, as we've talked about, is important, but it's one aspect of who we are and what we do. It's simply been where emphasis has been placed, perhaps a little too much for a little too long, but it is not some sort of final state of affairs that we cannot rebalance.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's one of the virtues of reading a bit of history, where you see things that seemed set in stone, you know, immutable, actually do change over time. And one of the things I've come to understand, and that it's sort of the main kind of thrust of what I write about, is the idea that consciousness itself evolves and changes over time, too. I mean, you mentioned Owen Barfield earlier, and he's someone who wrote about this and how he could detect a shift in consciousness through language. Other philosophers of, say, the evolution of consciousness have come to similar conclusions from different roots. And the sort of dialectic between the two sides of the brain, between sort of the outer tradition and the inner tradition, yes, it's been part of the Western. That's the whole thing. I think the dialectic itself is the Western tradition. And what we know as the Western tradition is one side. It's as if all we heard is, you know, one side of someone's phone call, as we often do today. You know, you're sitting in a cafe and you hear somebody chatting on their phone. That's sort of the Western tradition that we know, only one side of it. The other side of it, and that's why I call it the secret teachers, is that these are people that some of them we don't know, some of them we don't know that they were influenced by these ideas as much as they were. Some of them we don't really know what they were really saying. So it's secret in different ways, but it's this other side, you know, this other mode of consciousness, this other way of knowing that's been sort of sidelined, but it's there all the time, and it's informed, you know, all of Western culture, and it's still at work today. And so, no, it isn't at an end, and I do think it's the case that as Gebser says, we are experiencing a mutation in what you know, we understood to be this set, you know, kind of you know, done, finalized view of the world that is very much, you know, the 19th century materialistic science view of the world, which is kind of the trickle-down effect to the average kind of, you know, person's, you know, general kind of view of the world. But even in science itself, we've known this for like the last century at least, there's been all these different upsets and changes and all that. So, you know, as a species, we need a sense of security. We need a sense of something being stable and permanent to some degree, so that, you know, we can build on it, we can live, we can, you know, make plans at the same time. And so we tend to want that to be the case in different ways. And you can see the history of the West as a kind of tension between, you know, the people who want to maintain a particular point of view, because it's a very good one and it's worked and it's served its purpose, you know, excellently. And others who want, who can see, well, actually, no, it's, you know, we've moved beyond that, and there's this, and that's a dialectic between our need for security, but also we have a need for the new, for the adventure, to change, to develop, and so on, and so on. So I think we're certainly going through a time now where, I mean, and these things, they don't happen overnight. That's the other thing too. You know, people talk about some, you know, singularity or some kind of sudden shift in things. We don't experience them on our everyday level like that. They may seem sudden in historical time, but that's, you know, sudden in historical time is actually over, you know, quite a few years. Not to say there aren't these ruptures and breaks and fractures in history. I mean, you talk about something that was permanent and then isn't, you know, like the USSR, the Soviet Union. When I was growing up, it was, God, the other major superpower, and it was going to take over the world. Now it doesn't exist. So there are these kind of sudden, you know, collapses of things. But just, you know, in answer to what you were saying, or yes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we're involved in something that's still going on now. And that's what makes it living.
Well, I think also that for those that speak about singularity and its inevitability and its imminence, and those who speak about the fact that we're all doomed, and you know, human extinction is also inevitable, all life on them. I think that those polarities just reflect the sort of black and white thinking that we're talking about. That's not helpful. It's just got.
No, I agree.
Yeah. So, and to use your tree analogy, you were talking earlier about the idea that some of us want to just gaze at the tree, or some, you know, some mode of thinking wants to gaze at the tree, and another mode of consciousness wants to tear the tree down because we need to plow the field. We see, and not to be too fanciful here, but we see in more holistic ways of doing, not just of thinking, but of actually doing practical human things, whether it's the built environment, agriculture, the sort of things that we need to do to be healthy and happy on this planet, to work with the, you know, the rest of the life on the planet, to sort of balance. We see in a lot of systems now, grassroots, localized trends in these directions. You know, to literally to say things like, okay, well, we do need to plow some of the land, but we also want some trees to gaze at. Guess what? We can have both. And this is not, I can already hear in the background someone saying, but there's 7 billion people and counting, and we have to feed them all. I'm not saying here's my guidebook for practical solutions for everything. I'm simply saying that if we approach things with how can we do it in this balanced way, rather than saying, well, our starting point should be that it's impossible, that we have to go, you know, 100% in one direction or the other. I don't see that as particularly helpful. We should start and say, well, what do we actually want the outcome to be, and then work from there.
Mm. Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's, I guess it's having to deal with immediate problems, but having a long-range vision at the same time, you know, and sadly, politicians, you know, generally feel like they have to deal with the immediate kind of thing, and they don't think in terms of long-term. But I mean, you know, the ability I think to solve these problems exists. I think it's, again, this may sound like a cop out, but it's more to do with ourselves, and it has to do with being able to see things from a different perspective. No, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the problems of this mode of consciousness that Gebser, or this structure of consciousness that Gebser is saying is breaking down, that it is this kind of either or. And that's very left brain too, you know, and there's a manic sense to it, when it feels stress and it feels, you know, uncertainty. And this is when it has to be this kind of definiteness one way or the other, or one thing or the other. But, I think you're absolutely right. I think the potential to do both things exists. And I can only hope that, you know, we will be able to give ourselves enough time for, you know, for that to be more and more apparent, you know, more and more self-evident.
Well, I've looked at some of the work that, again, to think practically, some of the work that the, for example, people at Schumacher College are doing down in the south of England, or the Centre for Alternative Technology over there in Wales. And I'm not suggesting by any means that it's just going to involve folks like that and a smooth transition. Even thinking of the Transition Towns movement, the whole thing may become extremely messy. You know, there may be a period where it's deeply, deeply unpleasant for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. But one does. I mean, I think we have a kind of morbid romantic idea of, ooh, you know, the breakdown, and everyone's kind of been talking about that. I mean, the end of Western Civ to me is just like, that's been, like, since at least the 70s, you know. I mean, so that's when I first started hearing about what was happening, you know. Because the earlier, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the 60s, it was the opposite idea. It was like, yeah, you know, it was Star Trek. It was moving out, the new frontier and all that. But this kind of decline of sensibility has been going on, I think, for a while. And then in a way, we all kind of want it to happen. Though I have to say, I am, in one sense, I think it's a good thing there's been so many apocalyptic disaster films, because we maybe can exercise ourselves of this sort of imagery, this sort of imagination, this apocalyptic imagination on the screen, and so we don't have to kind of try to live it out. I mean, again, I think that's another left brain kind of thing. It wants this kind of absolute, solution to something.
Well, the reason I mentioned that things might get messy as we move through whatever it is ahead of us was, in order to not to romanticize it in a right brain way either. But ultimately that we're moving through a situation that has got its, that will have its back and forth, and it has its gray areas.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And that, for every moment of, ugliness or catastrophe, there's going to be something that's moving us closer towards balance. You know, darkest before dawn and those sort of ideas. I don't know what the future's going to look like, but I anticipate that, you know, centuries from now, there will be a human civilization on this planet, and I hope it will be a more integrated consciousness. I trust that it will be at some point, whatever that looks like.
And yeah, whether, absolutely, no, I'm all for that. I mean, I end on a hopeful note. You know, I'm not interested in saying what the new age is around the corner, because again, if you just look at history, there's been hundreds of new ages. You know, they've been around since recorded history, but the potential for kind of creative collaboration between, you know, our two polarities, I think is there. And, I think that's possible. And, I'm definitely hopeful. I mean, one of the things I don't say in the book, but I've said elsewhere in conversation with people, like, don't look on the news, you know, for evidence of this, you know? I mean, it's the sort of thing I don't think you can point to stuff in current events and say, oh, that's evidence of one way or the other. Because everything could be interpreted in many, many different ways. But I definitely have a hopeful feeling, you know, because I can see in the past that, yes, this kind of creative integration has happened before. And so there's no reason why it can't happen now. And it needs to. And that's another thing too. It generally happens when it needs to too. There's a kind of, inbuilt, you know, kind of cybernetic system where when things really get too out of balance, it cuts in. Now that might not be a picnic. You know what I mean? That the automatic system kicking in might not, you know, work in all nice ways, but that it's there to sort of, you know, reestablish a new polarity.
Well, Gary, today we've been talking about your latest book, as I mentioned earlier, The Secret Teachers of the Western World. And I think from some of the ideas we've been talking about, if folks do listen back to the earlier interview, Caretakers of the Cosmos, and also the Revolutionaries of the Soul talk that we did, I think people will find that a lot of this ties together quite nicely. Now, your new book is available everywhere, and also there's a lot of information in there, a lot of discussion about individual historical characters and interesting.
Yeah, maybe if we do it again, we can talk about some of the different characters and where, you know, the different figures and where they were in history and how they were involved in, you know, some of the pivot moments and things like that.
Yeah, exactly, because I think I said to you when we did Revolutionaries of the Soul that each one of these individuals is worthy of a book unto themselves. And indeed, as you mentioned earlier, you're working on a book on the late, great Colin Wilson. But just in conclusion for today, tell folks about your website and anything else you'd like to put out there.
Okay, well, if you want to get in touch, you can find my website at www.garylockman.co.uk. And, yeah, check it out. I have a lot of stuff there. There's quite a bit of stuff available on different sites at Reality Sandwich, their website, and The Daily Grail. And, yes, and by all means, if you're interested in the book, please get a copy, and I hope you enjoy it.
Splendid. Well, Gary, thanks once again so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
My pleasure, Greg. Thank you very much.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.